You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 26th of May 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Midori House here in London on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be visiting bookshops in Houston, Madrid and Istanbul.
Wood is good for books, I think, because with wood, the book also is very happy to be with wood, I think.
We'll be getting an update from DJ, producer and label consultant Christopher Tubbs to find out what songs have been on his radar and on his decks recently.
And we'll be joined in the studio by Stephen Watson, founder of Stack Magazines, who'll share with us his magazine discoveries.
All that coming up on The Review, live from Midori House on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House in London. It's a lovely summer day outside in London and not before time. This is The Review, here for the next hour with review-related things. Good
Absolutely.
Evening, Gillian.
Good evening, good morning, depending
is it
on which
good
time,
it's, no, it's
time
just,
zone.
Yes.
A little jet lag, Andrew.
Yes, you can tell I did the daily on Midori House yesterday. It's good evening somewhere. It was intended for those people in, you know, places further east.
Yeah.
Further west from here?
Where you herald
from, further
probably.
West. Indeed. It'd be further west. It's good evening to them. You are working on some review-related things yourself.
Yeah, well, we have a good... I mean, I'm starting to work on our quality of life films, which some of them are top secret. But I have a good selection of culture films coming up that I have in the works. And then I'm focusing a bit on fashion design schools, because I really am interested in incubating talent. And we're heading to the Antwerp Fine Art Fashion Academy for the graduation shows, where some of the really more conceptual designers of our times have come from. And just looking at that whole process of how you incubate talent and on film, that's just, I think, the best way to tell that story.
What's special or peculiar about the Antwerp School?
I suppose it's intellectual. It's really a very, very rigorous academic, concept-driven course, and hard, really tough. I mean, a lot of people drop up because they just can't take the workload, as well as the whole design and working on fashion. It's very intellectually challenging. In a way.
You make it sound more like joining the Marines than attending fashion college.
Boot camp, fashion boot camp. It is.
Indeed. Very well-designed boots they would be, of
All
course.
Right. Well, let's move on The Review. You're listening to Monocle 24, The Review. Stay tuned.
And we start, as ever, with a whistle-stop tour of various independent booksellers around the world.
So to kick off, we're going to head to Houston, where Charles Bronstein went to the Brazo bookstore.
I'm Jeremy Ellis. I'm the general manager at Brazos Bookstore in Houston, Texas. Brazos Bookstore is a community bookstore. It's small, about 3,200 square feet, located in the West University Rice area in Houston. We specialize in literary fiction, poetry, art, architecture, and sort of culture studies, big science books, history, biography. So it's a general bookstore, but we have very curated focus with all of our sections and try and carry the most interesting and best and most current titles in these special sections. We're located essential to a lot of very diverse neighborhoods. We have everyone from college kids to much older people who have been shopping here since the store opened in 1974. It's been a part of the Houston sort of cultural literary landscape for a number of years. I guess the book that I'm most excited about right now is called By Blood by Ellen Ullman. It's fiction. It's a novel set in San Francisco in the 1970s. And the narrator is this creep who has done something terribly, terribly wrong, although we're not entirely sure what it is. And he has left his job and taken up this office in a divey part of the city where he can hear through the walls. And there's a therapist next door who uses a white noise machine with every patient but one. And he begins to sort of become obsessed with what he's hearing through the walls and begins to insinuate himself into her personal discovery of finding out who she was. She's adopted and came from sort of mysterious circumstances. It is a fantastic read. It's very literary, but still kind of a page-turner thriller story. Really fantastic book. But that's out right now. The book that is that I'm most excited about that's coming next week, actually, on the 22nd of May, is Canada by Richard Ford. Pulitzer Prize winner, of course, and this book is just outstanding. It's a novel about a kid in the 60s whose parents sort of inexplicably rob a bank and how that basically screws up their entire life and what's going on. It's one of the most amazing novels I've read in years, and I can't wait for people to start to read it. It's going to be a big breakout hit this summer. James Donovan's Blood of Heroes is a new Alamo history, and that's doing really well here for us in Texas, of course. Buzz Bissinger's new story, he wrote Friday Night Lights, and he's written a personal memoir called Father's Day about a road trip that he took with his autistic savant son, and a really sort of different story than Friday Night Lights, a real personal tale, and we're really excited about that book.
That was Jeremy Ellis from the Brazos Bookstore in Houston.
I love the sound of cash at the beginning of that piece. Good to know that they're earning money, these small independent bookstores. Next, we head to Europe, and we hear from Madrid, where Monocle reporter Liam Aldiss went to the Libra bookstore.
This bookshop is called La Libre. My name is Julie, and I'm one of the two associates, business partners that we have here. And I'm English. I've been here 14 years. And Pilar, the other partner, she's Spanish. Basically, it's a bookshop cafe, secondhand bookshop now. We set up in 2004, originally as an alternative bookshop, left-wing, social themes, mainly in Spanish text, but we had a lot of English especially as well. And it went well. It went well for 6 years or so, and then we needed to change to keep up with the times, really, because with the changes in the book market, e-readers, digital books, and the fact that most of the publishers now are really keen to have digital books, we decided in the end to be able to stay alive, you know, and keep things going. As a literary cafe, really, we changed the model. So we're now a kind of retro-style, 80s-style cafe with second-hand books. This type of bookshop is quite a common format. I mean, in Spain, less so. It's mainly been traditional-style bookshops, which are quite academic. I mean, ours is quite bright. So we just thought we'd adapt it a bit more to the European feel. In Madrid, there are one or two more of this style of cafe bookshop, but I think it's most more on the English, perhaps European style. It's brightly coloured, try and keep things bright and fun and active and interesting for people. One of the things about a second-hand bookshop is you never know what you're going to find in books. So the texts come in, we have a recycling programme. Clients bring in their books if they want to. We don't buy them. What they do is they bring them in. They have their own account. We put a code on it. We display the best text, the ones we think are interesting, and we do it on trust, and it works very well. And they take a percentage, and they can reuse it if they want in the bookshop or in the cafe. So you never know really what we're going to get. We can get some amazing first edition text that, you know, is uncatalogued now. You just can't get hold of. It's out of print. To the latest bestseller, you just don't know. La Rapièce is a really multicultural area. So, for example, we've got El Mapa del Amor, which is by Adaf Souef. That's a really interesting text that's come in. It's practically brand new. Then there's another one called Saga by Tonino Benaquista from the publisher Lengua de Trapo. Again, an interesting text. And then, for example, in English, I mean, we've got Cry, the Beloved Country, which is a classic. Another text which won a fiction prize, which is Out Stealing Horses. So you really just, it can be a whole range of things, you know, from social to fiction to anything. Being in La Rapièce, we have a lot of artists, we have a lot of actors, dancers, we have all kinds of wonderfully interesting and diverse people here. People come in and they look, they can take a book, they can read it, they can sit down, they can chat. They don't have to buy the books, but it's part of the whole kind of the social cafe culture that we have here, but it isn't just about, you know, having a smoke and a chat and a beer. You get a lot of people that come in and read. You know, one of the things that we're going to start up very soon is a lot of cultural activities and literary activities related to the books. Madrid has always had a reputation of, or Spain really, as not being a culture that reads a lot, but I think that's not true. I think people do actually read a lot. Certainly it's my experience of having the bookshop.
Report from La Libre bookstore in Madrid. I can never decide whether the combination of books and food is a wise one or not?
I think in many instances it's the only way these bookstores can survive now. So I think it is quite a good idea. It just depends whether the people just read the books while they're having their coffee or whether they buy them.
It's just that they also do the sort of literary related food. And I'm just wondering if you get your Tom Sawyer salad or Rosalia de Castro toaster all over the thing that you're thinking about buying. Is it you kind of, you spill it, you own it sort of policy?
I quite like with this one. We always champion really well-curated bookstores, curated by the owners and the managers. This is an interesting concept. Well, it's really curated by the people who bring in their secondhand books. Well, finally, in our trio of bookstores, this week we're going to head to Istanbul, where reporter Ashley Creek went to visit Robinson Crusoe Bookstore.
My name is Burçin Kimmet. I am one of the partners of the Robinson Crusoe Bookstore. Robinson Crusoe Bookstore is on the Istiklal Street in Istanbul. We did open in 1994. Because we are searching for a good bookstore and we decide to open one. On the first floor, we do have mostly the English titles, English language titles. On the second floor, we do have Turkish language titles. And on the third floor, we do have office. We don't have enough place for books, even. The most popular section is English fiction and art books. The most popular book on this time is Haruki Murakami's last title, IQ 684. And we are selling some, not the best sellers, but the other Turkish fiction, literary fiction, we are selling very well. Tourists and the foreigners are looking mostly the some regional books, even in the literature, on the politics. But the Turkish readers are looking for something else. They are looking to the West, and the foreigners are looking to the East. A bookstore is a mix of people and books. What is important is not the design, only the person who works in the bookshop, the persons who came to the bookshop to buy something, and the books, nothing else, I think. So it was very easy for us because we did decide that we don't want to show a design, we want to show the books. Even on the window, we were trying to not to use a window because we thought that the bookstore is itself should be on the window, nothing else. But we have to put some little thing on the window for the new books. And wood is good for books, I think, because with wood, the book also is very happy to be with wood, I think. Maybe it's because of the tree. Wood is something who lives, the books also, if you care, maybe because of this.
It was Ashley Creek browsing the Robinson Crusoe bookstore in Istanbul.
This is The Review on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be joined by producer, DJ and label consultant Christopher Tubbs for our weekly music review. Stay with us.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Dance.
You are cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we talk comedy with New York stand-up Mike Birbiglia, iconic style with Jim Lee and Peter York, and head to Cuba for cocktails at the Havana Biennale.
To know about new art, new music, books, the people here is incredible.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. from Berenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller.
And it's time now to get from some musical recommendations for this week. And today, our guest curator, if you like, is DJ, producer and label consultant Christopher Tubbs. Chris joined us last year from his homeland of New Zealand, but now he's back in the UK. Chris, good afternoon.
Hello, Andrew.
How are you today?
I'm very good. I'm in London at the moment, so I'm basking in this almost equatorial heat.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? After what felt like 30 years of the most miserable spring ever, it's overcompensating out there furiously.
I know. If you walk down the street, there are almost kind of unsettling smiles in everyone's faces. It's just not inner city living.
But people in London are now actually smiling at strangers. God, this has got more serious than I thought. Do you have some music which is going to cheer people up still further?
I do. I thought we'd start today with a track called Beloved by a Swiss artist living in Berlin called Headman. His real name is Rob Insinner. And he owns the Relish Records label that this track came out on. Now, this track, I guess, is of note because it's very much representative of a very modern take on what essentially is a very retrotastic kind of sound and dance music. It recalls the late 80s in Chicago and the early 90s in Detroit, yet puts it in a very modern context. It's club music, basically, but it's also club music that you could play well right now.
I'm very fond of the word retrotastic. Is this the kind of music that's likely to get played by people driving up and down high streets in convertibles in weather like this?
Oh, I don't think so.
Good. Good. Well, that's a recommendation.
it's kind of, I guess, more at the more tasteful end of dance music. I mean, it might be played in convertibles, but they won't have lowered suspension.
Okay, well let's give it a try. This is the retrotastic Headman with Beloved. That was Headman with Beloved. I quite liked that. It reminded me of a slightly over-caffeinated Saint Etienne.
That would definitely be fair.
So, what do you have on this summer? You DJ a lot of events all over. What does your summer calendar look like?
Well, I do a few events in London. I do the Heads Down residency. Heads Down is the name of my blog, which is a sort of ongoing and fairly sporadic affair. I do this thing at Caravan, which is right in the middle of Exmouth Market, where they throw open all the windows and doors, and I play for 7 hours. So I play a kind of, you know, really broad spectrum of everything from kind of ambience to disco, weird, rare disco. And I do a few gigs in Ibiza, and that's about it generally these days.
So now that anyone can really be a DJ by curating anything on their MP3 players, how does the role of the DJ change, do you think?
I don't think the role of DJ has really changed. I think whilst, as you say, anyone can put together a playlist on their iPod, and some are obviously going to be better than others, I think the role of a DJ will always come down to their ability to filter the vast amounts of music that they're exposed to on a weekly basis. I mean, I, for example, have something like 400 promos that come into my inbox these days, digital promos per week. So the fact that I have to kind of make my way through this music and only bring the very best to people's attention is almost a full-time job.
What do you look for in the DJs that you decide to pay attention to?
I think an awareness of what's been and a hunger, of what's to come. People who just feel it's almost like a need that's hotwired into their DNA to be on top of things all the time.
Okay, well, what's the next selection you have for us today?
Now, I think you've got Pakwa, the Visitor, lined up. Is that right?
We can do, yes.
Now, Pakwa is a live band heralding from a record label called Claremont 56. And it's, as a label, very representative of what's known, I guess, as Balearic music. Are you aware of the term Balearic music?
I'm familiar with the term, yes. If I was going on Mastermind, it would probably not be my special subject, but I'm familiar with the
term. I'm not, so you can fill me in.
I'll tell you basically a little bit about Balearica. Basically, Balearic music is a term that comes from the late 80s on the Balearic Isles, of course, more specifically Ibiza. There was a DJ there called DJ Alfredo who played at Amnesia on a Friday night, and this guy would play everything from, you know, strange Italian pop by Lucio Battisti to U2 to Chicago acid tracks. And it's not a genre of music, it's more like a feeling that goes with music. The writer Bill Brewster described it once as pop music that sounds good on drugs, which I think is very unfair. It's not that at all. It's music with a certain euphoria to it. And this particular label specializes in Balearic music. And this particular band, this is a rarity in that it's actually a live band, consisting of a guy called Bing Ji Ling, who's from the phenomenal hand clap band, Alex Searle, and the owner of Claremont 56, a guy called Paul Mud Murphy.
Okay, well, I am not presently on drugs. Gillian?
No.
Okay, so it is going to have to speak to us on its own merits, so let's give this a try. This is Pakwa with Visitor. That was Pakwa with The Visitor, the second musical selection by our guest curator this week, DJ, producer and label consultant Christopher Tubbs. That was actually less Balearic than I was expecting. I quite like that. That's got a bit of that weird lachrymose soul almost of someone like Tindersticks, if not actually quite.
It does have a bit of that, and also I quite reminiscent of Terry Callier, I thought, as well.
Indeed, and that slightly weird, almost Dick Dalish surf guitar introducing it as well. That was quite sweet.
Good. I'm glad you like it. I think it was very much very very much geared towards a day like today in London.
You talk about Balearic. Is there another area around the world that's coming up with a kind of sound that's going to be really sort of big either this summer or this year, or just something where it has its own distinctive sound?
Well, there are all sorts of areas, especially in electronic music, that are forging their own sound. I think, you know, in terms of dance music, Berlin constantly is evolving from the clicky minimal techno of yesteryear through to the more sort of bass-heavy basement music of today. But you also have in America scenes like Duke, which are almost these sort of wildly syncopated rhythms, heavily acidic, very, very clunky electroid sort of sounds matched with the kind of the energy of hip-hop. So there's always things emerging, always kind of, bastard hybrids of different urban and left-field genres happening all the time.
Christopher, we were speaking earlier about the DJ's changing role, or the way the role of the DJ has been changed by developments in how music is played from vinyl to MP3. And you are something of a vinyl preservist. Is preservist a word? It is now. You have your own vinyl label, vinyl-only label. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's Untracked Recordings, and it's essentially a vinyl label that is almost worshipping at the shrine of the artifact of the 12-inch record.
Is it just about the artifact, or are you one of those people who think vinyl sounds better as well?
Vinyl, I think, sounds different.
Okay.
I think it's very hard to, scientifically prove that it sounds better. Broadband WAV or AIF sound file, as you would find on a CD. These days, if it's well mastered, well mixed, will sound as good as anything, really. I think anyone who tells you vinyl sounds better is kind of permanently based in 1985.
And they're probably one of those people who have really firm opinions about what speaker wire should be made out of. They always seem to end up sitting next to me on aeroplanes. It's a bit of a sore point.
That's more likely than the likelihood of winning a lotto, isn't it?
I think you have we have another track queued up, which you've suggested, Revealing. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, it's by a guy called Dave Adju, whose real name is Mark Barit. And this track comes from an album called Heirlooms. Now, it's an interesting concept for an album because it was something he originally planned to make with his father, who is a jazz musician, really, really active in San Francisco in the 80s and 90s, a guy called Joe Barit. And they planned for 3 years to make this collaborative album together. And his father died, unfortunately, just before they started production. Now, his father came from like a traditionalist jazz background, and Dave Adju comes from a very heavy electronic tech house dance music background. So it was always going to be an interesting collaboration. So unfortunately, due to the circumstances, he was left to trawl through this enormous archive of recordings that they'd made together over the time they were pulling the material together. And he's just done this amazing job of kind of matching these, really electronic sonic dynamics, I guess is the best way to describe it, with his father's traditional music.
Well, shall we have a listen? Yeah. Let's have a listen. And that was Revealing by Dave Adju. It's a Saturday here in London. Christopher, where do you like to go on a Saturday night in London to hear good dance music?
Well, it kind of really depends on the sort of Saturday night we're talking about.
Hot summer one.
I think in winter, I would say that Hicks Bar in Soho is one of my favourite haunts. Mark's Bar underneath Hicks. On this beautiful evening today, I'm going to head down for my residency at Caravan, which I talked about before. So, feel free to head down for a refreshing Prosecco.
Do you just want to remind everybody exactly where that is?
Caravan is in Exmouth Market in Farringdon in North London.
I know it well. I used to live not far from there, actually.
So, it's one of the best spots for coffee there is, I think, in London.
I think the Prosecco is sounding a little better. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Thank you so much, Christopher, and we'll probably check in with you later.
We'll be back right after this with a stack of magazines and the founder of Stack Magazines.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the culture section, Aisha Spears looks beyond the Steers and Stetsons to profile the gallerists and collectors at this year's Dallas Art Fair. Design Miami founder Craig Robbins talks us through his art, and there's a wonderful column on the art of wandering.
In the design section, we head north to Stockholm for a global exclusive of Ett Hem, a small hotel with big ambitions to shake up the hospitality industry.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest edition of The Entrepreneurs kicks off in Italy, where we'll be trying out the much-anticipated NTV high-speed rail network, being hailed as a transformative service for business travellers. We'll then be off to the West Bank, where some local entrepreneurs are bringing the traditional Arabic keffiyeh scarf back to life.
Buying one from Palestine helps the Palestinian economy more than buying one from China helps the economy. I'd rather have the real thing.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
It's Saturday. It's sunny in London. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Well, every week we like to indulge in a stack of magazines, but this week we thought we'd indulge in Stack magazines. And joining us now in studio is the editor and, well, the founder, in fact, Stephen Watson.
Hello.
Stephen, I wonder for people who didn't tune into the edition of The Review where you were with us last time, can you just sort of summarise what is Stack magazine?
Stack is a magazine subscription service for independent magazines. So you sign up and every month we send you a different independent magazine. You never know what you get next, but it's always going to be a beautiful, intelligent, lovely mag that you probably wouldn't have seen otherwise.
And like how many, what kind of volume are we talking about, the choice that you have, that you're sending through people's letterboxes?
At the moment we have, I think, around 20 titles on the site, and we send one a month. So obviously there's only 12 months in a year, so there's a big job in trying to make sure that we send a good spread of magazines over that 12 months. Obviously we don't send people the same thing twice. But, you know, kind of, we don't want to send people music magazines three times in a row or something. So we kind of try and mix it up with food, music, design, film, all sorts of stuff.
Are they magazines that will be on the newsstand, or are they foraged, the things that maybe just a bit more?
Some are on the newsstand. There are a couple that you'll be able to get in kind of the bigger WH Smiths, but the bulk of the selection is stuff that, yeah, you either have to be lucky enough to live somewhere like London and go to, you know, Magma or Artwords, or otherwise, yeah, I mean.
We always love it because you always bring magazines we've never, ever seen.
It's so, a point of pride.
So what's your first one that you're going to show us today?
First one's a magazine called Article, which is made by a couple of guys up in Sheffield. They're not actually from Sheffield. They went to university there and met there. And they've kind of stayed afterwards. And the city's actually kind of really integral to what they do. The sort of like the strap line, if you like, on the cover is arts, culture, urbanism. And if that makes it sound a little bit kind of blueprinty, it's actually really kind of quite sort of political, quite angry, actually, sort of outraged that the things that are going on, particularly in British cities, particularly in the north, but actually just looking across the whole country. And so they'll kind of they'll run a piece on the centre of Bradford, where Westfield bought up a big chunk of the city centre and demolished it for building a big shopping centre. And I think that was like 3 years ago, and there's still just a big hole in the middle of the city. And just the kind of the outrage, really, that that, you know, this is someone's city. This is where people live. And so they basically, they turn that into a really beautiful photo story with these kind of like sort of misty cityscapes in what looks like quite a kind of empty, depressed area. And all of the Westfield hoardings are of like beautiful people smiling and laughing and stuff. And it's really clever. I like the fact that they cover artists who don't necessarily look for an easy, simple message, and they don't seek to give an easy, simple message. So the theme of this issue is broken, and they kind of look at how broken can be bad, but actually how broken can be really good in places too.
There's an essay in on the subject of artists who, chaotic artists, I guess. I think chaotic's the right word. There's a long essay in this issue by Bill Drummond talking about his Bill Drummond, formerly of the KLF, talking about his music project, The 17, in which he gathers 17 people together in order to create one piece of music which is never recorded and never heard again.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly the sort of thing. I mean, you know, I think that...
Broken.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. It speaks to something about Stack, which is I have to be quite careful about not just choosing magazines that I like, but all of this stuff really kind of speaks to something that I think actually... It doesn't kind of get represented in sort of mainstream media, and that's one of the reasons that I really like independent magazines in the first place.
The pictures of the Westfield Hole, as they call it, are fabulous. That I know you get into a bit of a weird area when you're trying to kind of describe photos on the radio, but there's just one shot of a slightly put-upon woman walking past this immense holding saying Westfield Bradford, which obviously blocks out the hole behind it, but just behind it you can sort of see the ghosts, a ghostly sort of backdrop of Bradford's remaining cityscape. It's a lovely picture.
I don't know whether they waited for a particularly bleak, misty morning or whether that's what Bradford's like every morning, but I'm from East Yorkshire, so I don't go over that side too often.
You talk about this being sort of angry, and they come with anger at it, but it's not, the listener might imagine it to be kind of grungy agitpop. It's beautifully produced.
Yeah,
it looks good.
They started the magazine while they were at university, and then they've now graduated, so they stayed there. And kind of when I first saw Article, it wasn't grungy, but it was definitely, there was more kind of black and white in there. They used to use kind of one spot colour for a particular section. It's just a cheap way of kind of bringing a bit of variation. And they've kind of carried that idea on. So while the magazine is now full colour throughout, at the very front they've used this like really kind of powerful fluorescent orange. So they're kind of like, they're staying in touch with where they came from, but developing it and making it a little bit sort of more professional, if you dare say that.
You spoke earlier about not just wanting Stack magazines to be about sort of promoting magazines that you personally happen to like on your subscribers. What is it you do look for in a magazine? What makes a difference between you looking at a magazine thinking, yep, that goes on the service, or no, that one doesn't?
I think the thing it always comes down to is what's it saying. There are lots and lots of magazines out there that look beautiful and you know, lovely, and you kind of get past the first few pages and you realise there's kind of nothing really in it. There's no voice, there's no personality. And I think that especially because a lot of these magazines are made by people who do a full day at work or college or whatever it is, and then they come home and they switch a computer on and then they just start again, and they're probably not getting paid anything for it. And so really the reason that they're doing this is because they are so passionate about what they're talking about. They can't stand the idea of a world in which this magazine doesn't exist. And I think that really kind of comes across.
The second one on your pile, what do we have here?
Okay, so this is a magazine that's not actually a magazine yet. It's called Day Job Magazine. It's been made in New York. And this is kind of an issue zero. It was given away for free, I think, in New York. I got sent a copy. One of the nice things about doing Stack is I get magazines sent to me all the time. And this is, it's printed on newsprint. It's deliberately kind of like a cheap sort of an experiment. And I just checked on their site yesterday, actually. They've got their Kickstarter funding.
So this is what I wanted to ask about. Day Job, I'm clearly right in saying, has been launched by crowdfunding.
Yes.
Are you finding this is a common thing?
Yes.
And is it working?
I think it's a great idea. In fact, that I'm giving, I'm part of some talks happening at The Guardian next month. And as part of that, I've been contacting a lot of publishers who have kind of different business models, different ways of making sustainable magazines. One of them is a magazine called Remedy, which is a food magazine. It came out, they're based in New York. And they launched 2 years ago with Kickstarter funding. They totally busted out of the limit that they needed, so they had plenty of money to start with. And they had a ready-made subscriber list for their first year because most people pledged money for a year's subscription. Obviously, then they found there was a massive drop-off at the end of that year, which they hadn't really kind of anticipated. But by that point, they'd got enough of a magazine together, enough of a following, that they could carry on, keep going, print the next issue. And then they just basically started looking at new strategies for finding customers. Without Kickstarter, they would never have got off the ground. They wouldn't have been able to take the first step. So I think it's actually a really great thing.
That Kickstarter is really quite North American. What about in the rest of other parts of the world? Do they have similar kind of crowdsourcing?
Anyone that I know in the UK who has done it has actually used Kickstarter, and they've just got someone in America to open the bank account for them. And you know, so the money goes there. I know, obviously, that there are lots of crowdfunding sites that are specifically British, but I don't know why they haven't taken.
I do wonder whether it might be one of those things that, you know, one of those Atlantic divides. Speaking as an outsider to both countries, one of the things I do enjoy when I visit America is whenever you go to Americans with some idea or some project, you just get this incredible enthusiasm and people going, hell yeah, let's see if we can do that. Whereas the default response of the British tends to be, here's why that won't work. The British are usually right, by the way, but do you think the idea of the sort of the crowdfunding thing is it as easy as, because it taps so obviously into that great American optimism. Do you think it will take off in the same way here for magazine publishers?
I think it could do. I think that maybe a more interesting question is whether it should all go the way that it is at the moment. So I read recently quite an interesting critique of Kickstarter, which basically looks at the amount of money that they kind of like take off the top as a commission, and basically asked, like, you know, hang on, what is this money for? And kind of, you know, really systematically went to the site and worked out that, you know, this thing that's been held up as an exclusively good thing in the world, actually there are loads of better ways of doing it. And they actually posited a site called Self-Starter. They said, why doesn't someone make this open source? And so that basically anyone can get access to the sort of mechanisms that Kickstarter has. All right, you won't get included on an email that goes out to people every week, but how many actual projects go on that email anyway? That, I think, could be really, really interesting when you get away from it being centralised around one site and when it actually breaks out kind of around the world. But I don't think there's any reason why a British magazine couldn't fund itself through Kickstarter or something like it. I think that it's the sort of the way that independent publishing is, it's crying out for people to do exactly that.
I suppose it does kind of, because in a way it's not dissimilar at all from just the time served transaction of subscribing to a magazine. You pay them a certain amount of money on the understanding you'll get the next year's worth of issues. But I suppose the appeal of this maybe is that it makes that transaction feel more personal. It's literally an investment rather than just a purchase.
Exactly, yeah. And also you know kind of the things that you purchase, the one of the common things that people do is they put for a certain amount of money, they put your name in the front of the magazine. For a bit more money, you get kind of some kind of sell access to like the editorial board, so you get to kind of decide what's going to go in this magazine. I think it's a really good idea. It just depends how people execute it.
Let's move a little bit back. I love the concept of day job, and I wonder if you can tell us what the idea
we got swept away, didn't we? Day job is about the workplace, and obviously there are lots of magazines that have done this in a more kind of corporate way. This magazine really looks at the people that are there. So, you know, and it's one of the oldest kind of tricks in the book is that when you're talking about something in a magazine, no matter what it is, you're actually talking about people because people like to read that stuff. And they seem to have a real kind of affinity for the underdog as well. The lead story is a company in Manhattan that makes those kind of wheeled ladders that that you use in libraries. And, you know, so you can like push the ladders along the thing. Apparently they've had this building for just like, you know, generations. And on either side, they have like huge multinational corporations. And there's just this tiny company making wheeled ladders. And they basically don't want to sell their property because it's full of ladders. And where else would the ladders go? And it's just this sort of like kind of dogged, kind of bloody mindedness that, you know, I'm not going to move. This is where I am. There's another story in there about kind of Little League baseball and what it means to kind of give your time to, not Major League Baseball, but the lower leagues, to devote your time to this sport, which even, you know, compared to basketball and American football, which are really taking off, apparently baseball is kind of folding in on itself.
I'm reading here. It says that the background to a day job is a magazine for anyone who's ever had a job they've loved, a job they've hated, a lifelong calling, or a way to make an easy buck. In short, it's about a celebration of the everyday ways in which we spend our time and energy. The potential for stories there is
huge. Exactly. It's for everybody.
Well, it is limitless. And the one you mentioned, especially the people who make the wheeled ladders for libraries, at the risk of, you know, returning everything to the kind of people I end up sitting next to on airplanes, it's one of those jobs when if you ask someone what do they do and they tell you I make those wheeled ladders that go in libraries, you know, okay, the rest of this flight is either going to be excruciating or really interesting, depending on the kind of person they are. If you meet somebody who actually says, this is what I do, here's why it's an interesting and exciting thing to do, those stories can be great. Monocle covers stories, I think, like that really well. I remember years ago Monocle sending me to Denmark to interview people who made those blades on wind turbines, which initially I was sort of thinking, really? But it turned out to be an absolutely fascinating story.
Yeah, and I bet it was fascinating partly because of the people who were there doing this stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. People who really knew a lot about wind turbines.
Next on your list?
Okay, so next up we have a magazine called Offscreen. And there's been it's always kind of tempting to try to pick out sort of movements in magazines and trends. This isn't a trend, it's two magazines. This magazine, Offscreen, is made by a guy called Kai Brack, who is based in Melbourne. He is a freelance web designer, but has decided that to try to get out to the world an idea of what it's like to be a web designer, he made a magazine. And this came out kind of a couple of months after a magazine called The Manual, which is made by a guy called Andy McMillan, who's based in Belfast. And The Manual is more kind of the philosophy of web design and kind of like, you know, the ideas behind it. Offscreen is very much about the people who make it. In fact, I interviewed him recently, and he is very open saying that Monocle is his main kind of inspiration for this. because he kind of, I'm not sure if he travelled the world himself, but he emailed lots of people around the world and put together a really, really good-looking magazine which goes into web designer studios, talks to them about like their working day, what can they see out of their window. You know,
it's interesting that they're using print to do that, not having some online blog.
Exactly. Both of these guys whose entire lives are based in web have chosen print as a way of kind of getting a message out there. And so I asked Kai, you know, kind of why he'd decided to do that. And he was saying that, actually, you know, he's always loved independent magazines. And these days he finds that a good magazine is the only thing that can make him put down his iPhone, his iPad, switch
his
off
mouse.
The computer. Exactly. And just kind of focus specifically on one thing. And, you know, I'm very careful about not saying... I think people expect me to be the guy who comes in and says print is just magical and beautiful and it will always live forever. And I don't think that's the case. But I do think that it does some things really, really well. And I think it's really interesting that these two web guys have picked up some of the things that print does well.
There's a bunch of day in the life interviews at the top of Offscreen with people who work in design and stuff. It's another one of those illustrations I think I mentioned of that Atlantic divide. All the interviews with Americans are about how they bound out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning and do yoga and eat something really healthy, and then how creative and excited about their day ahead. And the one British guy interviewed, 8 a.m., woken back up, get mildly annoyed by breakfast radio, but continue listening as it forces me out of bed.
There you go. I happen to think that maybe the British just been a little bit more honest with that.
But it is a beautiful-looking magazine. It smells nice as well.
They all smell nice.
But this really is one of those magazines that really, really does. But thank you very much for coming in today, Stephen Watson,
founder
of Stack Magazines. It has been a pleasure. We will have you in again soon, I'm sure. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
But that's all from us here on The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller. Have a very, very good weekend.